They say that we can't criticize their dishonest coverage because of the First Amendment. You know, they always bring up the First Amendment. And I love the First Amendment. Nobody loves it better than me. Nobody. I mean, who uses it more than I do?
Hello and welcome to episode 71 of the Right Dishonourable podcast. I am Jimmy and I'm joined as per usual by the lovely Jazza, who is laughing at me already.
I mean, I don't know why, but the more you say exactly the same words every single week, I find it more and more hilarious. We're joined today by another guest. Jimmy's been very prolific with the booking.
That makes me sound like I'm inviting anyone. You shouldn't just say that, you know.
No. I'm commending you for the work that you're doing. Would you be able to introduce yourself for our lovely listeners?
Sure. My name is Richard Seymour. Mm-hmm. I'm an author. Last book was about Jeremy Corbyn. Corbyn, the Strange Rebirth of Radical Politics. A complicated rebirth, must be said. And I write for the LRB, Guardian, Vice, Al Jazeera, various other things. And I'm a founding editor of Salvage magazine, which is a magazine of menace and despair.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Essentially, the idea of the magazine, it's a magazine of the left, but the left has been in decline and degeneration for about a generation more. Mm. And this is the name Salvage is about what sort of bricolage can we recuperate, right? It is a magazine that is openly pessimistic about the present and about the future, because the left tends to live in a bubble. It tends mm-hmm. to live in sort of like the hope that every new protest movement, every new march, is going to turn the situation around, and suddenly we'll be living in a left-wing country, and that's mm-hmm. not going to happen.
No.
So there's a kind of slightly religious ecstatic impulse behind it. One of the slogans that we have is, between salvation and garbage, there is salvage. And that's kind of where we are, somewhere between salvation and garbage.
Christ.
Awesome.
Wow, that's a lot
more. I mean, there's a lot more thought than has gone into anything that we've ever done on The Right Dishonourable.
That is definitely true. speaking of left-wing pessimism, the the first topic, joint topics here, are the election results in Stoke and Copeland.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, a slight mixed bag from Labour's point of view, and given Richard's expertise covering Corbyn, we are going to be sort of analysing it from that point of view. And as our second topic, we are going to be discussing the potential fall of Milo Yiannopoulos, the controversialist.
Why do you say potential fall?
Well, so Milo Yiannopoulos said some comments about sort of relationships between minors and adults, sexual mm-hmm. relationships, and he's had to resign from Breitbart. His book deal has been scrapped, at least for the time being. Mm-hmm. There's some indications that other publishers are interested, and he's also talked about a new media venture. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that we are necessarily seeing the fall of Milo. I think we're potentially seeing the rebirth of him in the fullness of time.
God.
But yeah, we were
And he has been a slight obsession of ours on the podcast.
We have mentioned him more times than I would
than
like.
Than is necessary.
And now we're going to be devoting a good 20 minutes to discussing him. So yes.
Well done, Milo, you got what you wanted.
Yeah. Endless attention.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it has worked out for him. But, and potentially as a third topic, we will also discuss this case involving a straight couple that are pursuing the government to try and get the right to have a civil partnership. At the moment in the UK, straight couples can only get married, they can't get civil partnerships, and the court decided that because the government is reviewing the situation at this point, it mm-hmm. will not take their case any further, but it's very much on a hiatus, that case, I suppose. So mm-hmm. those are our three topics. To go back to the first one.
Yeah, diving straight into by-election fever that struck the nation.
Do you want to explain once again? Do you want to explain what the results were to start off with?
So these were two Labour seats, one of them in Stoke-on-Trent Central, which was previously held by Tristram Hunt, who was a bit of a Labour Blairite darling, who's now off and organising the V&A Museum, which I'm sure he'll do a very good job. It's a lovely museum. there was concern about specifically the Stoke-on-Trent Central by-election because Labour don't have the biggest of margins ahead of UKIP and the Conservatives, who were kind of like pretty much tied for second place in the 2015 election.
Mm. And they're still pretty much tied now after the by-election, aren't they?
Yeah, so we've ended up with a result that has Labour keeping the seat with 12,000 votes, but then UKIP getting about 7,000 and the Conservatives getting about 7,000. So more people voting for right-wing parties.
Right-wing parties.
Yes.
than Labour, but Labour still holding the seat, isn't first past the post.
And so brilliant. In Copeland, the story was a bit different.
Yes, and so in Copeland, where there is a large, like the nuclear industry is a large employer there, Jeremy Corbyn has been a vocal opponent of the nuclear industry.
Is that the nuclear industry including just energy, or is that weapons principally? Or is it both?
I don't know. I think it's energy, isn't it?
There's a former, I mean, it's being converted to this place, Windscale, mm-hmm. Or what it used to be called, Windscale, I forget what it is now. But it was nuclear energy, I think. Mm-hmm. The idea is it's supposed to be converted, but that's going to take a while.
So there was a swing in this particular seat away from Labour, and Conservative ended up being the first government in about 30 years to win a seat off of the opposition
in a by-election. Yeah.
And then Theresa May jaunted up there and had a lovely little press conference in front of the new MP, who's Trudy Harrison.
Yes.
Does this, specifically the loss in Copeland, does this loss really say as much about the state of Labour as the mainstream media would want it to? Or is this kind of like a bit of a microcosm that is very specific to the local industry, and the fact that that goes contrary to Corbyn's own policies and views?
I think the role of the nuclear industry actually is a little bit exaggerated. These results are not good for Labour in either seat. Mm-hmm. However, what happened in Copeland, I think, if you look at it, it's the collapse of UKIP. UKIP was dividing the right-wing vote, and what has been happening, it's an interesting sort of dialectic, what's been happening in Britain for the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, has been a shift to the right under the impact of austerity, recession, mm-hmm. all the rest of it. And UKIP has been the sort of vector pushing forth this right-wing radicalisation. But in so doing, it's also been splitting the right-wing vote. Mm-hmm. Now with Brexit and Theresa May's turn to a kind of hardcore Brexit, the right-wing vote is being reunified under the rubric of the Conservatives. So what happened there was the UKIP vote fell by about 8.5 percentage points in terms mm-hmm. of the total share of the vote. Tory vote increased by 9 percentage points. Labour, on the other hand, seems to have lost some votes to the Lib Dems. So Brexit has reorganised the national political terrain. Mm. Lib Dems have a very clear Remain position. I think totally unsustainable, it's not going to work, but nonetheless mm-hmm. it's very clear. And people are attracted to the clarity of the positions.
Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in like the Richmond by-election. That yes. was a seat that voted to remain in the EU, but then ended up having Zach Goldsmith as a representative who was
a leave
yeah. proponent.
Yeah, and also his racist London mayoral.
Yeah, also, yeah. yeah. The
probably
London
didn't help.
Race,
No, I mean, that's happened. But what Stoke is slightly different because the UKIP vote didn't fall there. It actually increased slightly.
Mm-hmm. Increased by about 2 percentage points.
That's right. There's been, I mean, I never thought that UKIP was going to take the seat from Labour. I think that was massively exaggerated. Mm-hmm. If you look at it, their share of the vote was about just over a fifth, and it rose to just under a quarter, mm-hmm. by 2 percentage points, as you say. And that was always going to be the case, because the pattern thus far for UKIP has not been to take votes, most of its votes, from Labour. Despite what people say, if you actually look at its performance in northern industrial towns, it takes existing right-wing working-class votes, mm-hmm. votes that would have went for the BNP, the English Democrats, or the Tories, or just wouldn't have voted, and assembles them into a big electoral bloc. And that's, you know, that's important that they're doing that, and it's worrisome for Labour. But they were never going to take Labour votes in bulk. What's really happened is in the last, I don't know, 20 years, Labour's vote in all of these constituencies has been tanking long term, and you know, this is just the culmination of that. Corbyn's you know, leadership obviously has something to do with it, but it can't be reduced to that.
How much of it do you think? Do you think that UKIP would have been able to have more momentum and pick up more than an increase of 2% of the vote if they hadn't had Paul Nuttall there, who was very much like in the traditional UKIP way, they parachuted their leader du jour into whatever by-election is happening. Paul Nuttall got an awful lot of pushback in local media in Stoke.
There was a whole scandal over the Hillsborough, his particular involvement in the Hillsborough
so
football
claiming
disaster.
That he lost, he knew people who died in the Hillsborough
knew people
disaster.
Who died. He also claimed at some point, or one of his, you know, some of his leaflets did, that he was actually there at the Hillsborough disaster, and then he backtracked on all of this.
There was a claim that he was a professional footballer at one time. You know, I mean, seriously, this guy is... But, I mean, let's be clear. There's an awful lot of radical right-wing bullshitters out there, and bullshit usually doesn't sink them. Trump lied and lied and lied, and he still won. So,
but Paul Nuttall doesn't have the charisma of Farage or Trump.
No, that's I agree with you. Yeah. That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, he's a bit of a loser. And,
oh, bless him.
And Paul Nuttall's of the UKIP. I mean, Jesus Christ, this guy, everything he says, he sounds just like a whiny... regional Englishman.
He may have done a little bit better were he standing in the seat where he actually had history. He's like a proud Liverpudlian, which isn't really near Stoke.
They're not proud of him.
No.
Nigel Farage actually said if UKIP didn't win this seat, the seat in Stoke, that it would be a disaster for them. So do you take that reading? Do you think it's correct?
No, because there's factionalism within UKIP. I mean, here's the thing. I think Nigel Farage was the only leader who could unite that sort of heterogeneous bloc. I mean, it's filled with various elements, libertarian elements, really right-wing authoritarian elements, some fascist Nazi bits circling around. It's a really heteroclite group. And Farage, with his charisma, with his particular skill as an advocate... mediating between sort of mainstream media discourse and sort of average bigoted Johnny around the flats or whatever, you know, like, or, you know, like the sort of regional suburban kinds of bigotry could be translated into an idiom that people could accept coming through the mainstream media. That's what Farage was good at as an advocate. Paul Nuttall is not that kind of person, and nobody else was going to be that kind of person. So I think to some extent it's the loss of the charismatic leader, you're right, to highlight charisma. In a media age, that's just really important. But it's also, to some extent, the reason why Paul Nuttall is where he is because, you remember, they elected a woman whose name I can't even remember now, but she was like a sort of... She was like a regional manager for a market research company.
We have forgotten her name. Isn't that just... I'll find out. Keep talking. Diane James.
There she is.
She was leader of UKIP for...
8 days or something?
I thought it was like nearly 2 weeks.
It might have been that.
Yeah.
She was competent... But she was competent in the way that, you know, if she worked for a market research company and was giving a regional sort of sales presentation or something like that, you go, okay, she knows what she's doing, but not as a sort of national leader. But she was manoeuvred against. So there's a sort of pro-Farage faction, and then there was a sort of group of so-called modernisers around people like Douglas Carswell.
Who is more of the... Like, he's the only MP that UKIP actually have in Parliament, and he comes from more of the libertarian wing.
He does,
Paul Nuttall was seen in the last leadership election as kind of like the successor to Farage, more so than the other candidates, though, right?
Yeah, I mean... Politically, he might be, but he's just not got... I mean, I don't know if they have anybody who would have the charisma, the clout in terms of political experience, and the ability to navigate between different factions. So I think also the fact is that Brexit happened. Now, that's mission accomplished for UKIP. I mean, they do have a broader series of politics, but Brexit is the key thing. And since the Conservatives have made it very clear that they're swinging hard behind Brexit, and Theresa May has adopted the sort of, we're going to have a red, white and blue Brexit, all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, that was vapid garbage, but essentially... it says very clearly that the Conservatives are going in a right-wing nationalist direction. Who needs UKIP anymore?
I don't know. I feel like UKIP still actually have a really good position that they could take when it comes to immigration and like the reduction of numbers. Because frankly, they're never going to be in a situation where they're going to have to make decisions about reducing immigration. And it's really difficult for any government to be able to reduce immigration just by numbers because... because we need immigrants. Surprise. But I think that they have that line that they can quite easily take, and they can feed off of those views, especially in the north of England. And I was actually, I think that UKIP did come second in the Stoke by-election, and I think that were Paul Nuttall not such a terrible candidate, I think it could have been a lot more difficult for Labour on the night. What do you reckon, Jimmy?
I don't know. I kind of buy Richard's analysis.
Well, fine. I'm sorry. Attack me.
Sorry. I mean, I'm kind of interested, actually. Do you think that UKIP is now just going to be this presence that draws votes away from the Tories? Or do you think they're going to just dissipate eventually? What is UKIP's future after this?
Well, the guys around, like Aaron Banks, Farage and others, want to go in the direction of a kind of five-star movement.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, like, or a Tea Party-style movement, if you can think about it like that. So they've decided there's no longer the space or the time for a party, a broad right-wing party. What we need is a lobby that will keep harrying the Conservatives and pushing it to the right. And that was basically, I think, the function of UKIP. It was to shift parliamentary democracy in Britain to the right and to the more authoritarian and racist right. I think you said something important, though.
Mm-hmm.
The question of immigration, just like Europe... As long as they don't get what they want, they derive energy from that.
Conservatives.
If they were to get what they wanted, it would be disastrous in many ways for Britain, but it would also be a disaster for them because that would immediately destroy their basis. I mean, it would be complicated because the more you give the right, kind of... The more they sort of grow in some ways. But I think what we're looking at in the next few years, it's not so much UKIP that I'd be worried about. If you think about the economic collapse that might come, mm-hmm. I mean, we don't know, but it seems likely that with Brexit and the loss of half of Britain's trade, privileged trading access to Europe, mm-hmm. half of Britain's trade, the loss of that and the damage that would be done to Britain's growth model, which is, you know, horrible sort of city-driven, property-driven, you know, bubble-driven sort of growth. If all that collapses, you can see what's going to happen there. The property-owning democracy that makes up the basis for consensual conservatism, that is going to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And these people aren't going to go sort of rally behind some sort of nice guy like Jeremy Corbyn, or they're not going to hang around the centre. They're going to go to the hard right, and some groups in Britain are going to go to the fascist right. We're going to be talking about the kinds of people who murdered Joe Cox, not UKIP.
So
and I think we'd be talking about a far right in Britain rather than anything else.
I think that Labour actually got quite lucky with this because actually left-wing parties did not get a majority of votes in this election. I actually got the numbers wrong when I first said it.
Yeah.
Labour actually got nearly 8,000 and about 5,000 between UKIP and the Conservatives. So actually the right, as you describe it, the broad right, did win this election, but because of the voting system that we have, Labour were able to hold on. Doesn't that, if that ends up getting replicated or if like the Conservatives or UKIP can organise better around these places where Labour don't have a plurality of votes and are more vulnerable, do you not think that these kinds of seats, when it comes to 2020 probably being our next election, don't you think that these seats are going to be in a huge amount of danger?
No, I think the vote...
Well, there we go, sorted.
I just think the vote's going to continue to be split, because I don't think UKIP is going to fold itself up.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think... I mean, I think the UKIP... Insofar as they have a base there, it's because they're not as conventionally Tory.
Mm-hmm.
There are right-wing working-class voters there who are not straightforwardly Tory. They're very right-wing, but they want a kind of populist kind of right-wing policy.
So does that contrast with your assertion earlier that UKIP were drawing votes mainly from the Tories rather than from Labour?
I think that's true, but it's what's happened over the last 20 years is that the Conservative vote, and you saw this after Black Tuesday and 1992, the Conservative vote, especially in sort of those sorts of working class areas, began to disintegrate. And it didn't go to one other party. It went to a lot of fragments. Like there was a far-right Christian party, there was the English Democrats, there was the BNP that was doing well for a while, and there was a lot of people just not voting. So I think that that's the sort of trajectory. What's happened is that UKIP has canalised all of these different tributaries into one sort of electoral formation. And what has happened is that they are, to some extent, these people are very traditional Thatcherites, you know. They want a sort of populist Thatcherism in its insurgency phase. They don't want post-Thatcherite conservatism.
When you say Thatcherism, are you talking about free markets and social conservatism?
Yeah, the sort of there was a division that used to be made in Thatcherism between the sort of the mods and the rockers, right? So Ken Clark was one of the mods, you know, like free markets, but kind of social liberalism, consensual, blah blah blah. And Thatcher and Norman Tebbit and so on were the rockers, and you can see the likes of Farage and the people he got around him in the mid to late 1990s. As the rocker wing of conservatism, who became very disaffected with the pro-European stance that the conservatives were taking, and very disaffected, obviously, with the economic failures of the British model, which were very clear at that time until, you know, there was a long boom. So I think that what's happening is that Theresa May would have to do a lot of work to pull those people back towards sort of traditional Toryism, and I don't think it's going to happen in the next few years.
Isn't she sort of laid the groundwork for that, with, at least rhetorically speaking, with, you know, the talk of like bringing in people who are left behind, and, you know, a slightly more assertive approach to the market as well?
Yeah, but it's not going to be matched at the level of policy,
right?
I mean, this is triangulation. So I think what's going to happen in the next few years is Brexit's going to go bust, essentially, and that's going to seriously, I mean, it's going to create a very volatile situation.
So you believe the kind of cliff edge thesis then, that when Brexit finally does happen, it will be disastrous and not just merely damaging to the economy?
I think the British economy, the global economy, frankly, is very, very weak. If you look at what was happening in the last few years, corporations were hoarding billions, tens of billions, globally hundreds of billions of pounds of cash. Because there just wasn't an avenue for profitable investment. So what they did was they rediverted it into the financial system. And that's the basis upon which we've had some sort of return to growth. But that's not sustainable in the long term. So we've got a return to sort of bubble-driven growth. And I think that it wouldn't take very much. I mean, and frankly, for Britain to lose suddenly privileged access, tariff-free access to half of its trading market, without being able to, and you know, you can't just immediately move towards the Atlanticist Arcadia that they're talking about. You know, like, well, okay, so have a bilateral treaty with Trump. He's going to give you a fair deal. The artist of the deal is going to give us fair conditions.
I mean, the man who paid somebody to craft the art of the deal. Let's be fair.
But I mean, he is a bit of an artist, you know, in various ways.
A con artist, perhaps.
Yeah, well, you've met before me.
Yeah. So, but I mean, what was the other idea? We're going to make deals with America and maybe get a bilateral deal with Europe. Probably wouldn't be a very good one, to be honest. They'll want to punish us.
There's
and
been desire to reach out to, like, the colonies.
They're going to buy our stuff. We're going to bring back British colonialism, make Britain great again. I mean, that's essentially, this is all rooted in, I think, long term, a feeling that Britain has been in decline since it lost the colonies. And Thatcherism was all about, you know, rule Britannia, Falklands, all that sort of stuff. It was all about restoring British dynamism and vitality and potency. And that's kind of the underlying, I think, political dynamic of UKIP.
That's definitely a dynamic of it. I mean, it sounds as though Brexit is almost a detail, though, in your idea of global economic collapse. Because, if these problems are as systemic as you think they are, then whether Britain is tied into Europe or not presumably doesn't make a huge amount of difference.
No. I don't think that at all, actually. I think that you've got an existing series of global institutional relationships which Trump and Brexit and Marine Le Pen and so on are going to attack from the right. And these relationships are basically global liberalism, what Washington has been backing for a long, long time. And they have been the basis upon which growth has been achieved. Now, there's been all sorts of injustice, inequalities. It's very undemocratic. These institutions are what you might call post-democracy, and that's the basis of the right-wing sort of insurgency. But what's going to happen there, that model is weak, but destroying it...
is worse.
Destroying it in a way that just leads to some sort of right-wing autarky, which is the kind of... a wing of Trumpism just wants to, like... retreat from multilateralism, have bilateral deals, put protectionist tariffs on Chinese goods. If they tariff Chinese goods, American consumption is going to go way down. It might be good for them in the long run, but I mean, you know, in terms of the consumers, but it's actually going to be really it's going to be very miserable and unhappy for them, and it's destroying these relationships in a way that's not creative, it's not productive, it's not giving rise to anything new. I think the cliff edge thesis is intimately related to the whole breakdown of the establishment, breakdown of the existing set of institutions.
But then we are actually reinforcing the establishment in this country, I think, more so than flipping the table over is what happened with a Trump presidency in the US. Like, people voted to leave the European Union, but then the most establishment of the parties, at least at the moment, the Conservatives, are able to be like, hold on, don't worry, guys, we've got this.
Yes.
We're taking the wheel. And they're actually going to be the architects that end up creating the Britain that comes out of the European Union and are going to be able to reinforce and entrench their version, at least, of the establishment more than ever before, possibly.
I feel we should, just before we move on from this topic...
I was going to say, how did we get onto this when we're talking about Stoke and Copeland?
Well, how do you think, because obviously you've discussed what you see as the right wing in all of this, but how does Corbyn kind of provide an alternative to that in your view? Because I've read a bit of your book on Corbyn, and you seem quite positive, I guess, about him, or certainly more positive than some of the alternatives.
I'm sympathetic to what he's trying to do. Mm-hmm. I'm sceptical that he can do it. So this is the...
What do you understand as what he's trying to do?
He's trying to regenerate social democracy from the left.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's not... this is not Ben... although he is a Benite, that's where he comes from.
You're referring to Tony Benn.
Tony Benn. You know, Tony Benn's idea of socialise the major industries, have workers' control of industry, you know, radical democracy from below, all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. This is not what Corbyn's talking about. He's talking about Wilsonite policy, you know, corporatism, negotiations between business and workers and government and blah, blah, blah. A little bit of planning, a little bit of government intervention to stimulate high technology industries, all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, he's trying to rebuild classical social democracy from the left by rebuilding the Labour Party's grassroots, by rebuilding its membership. And there was always an element of contradiction in that. It's true that Corbyn wouldn't have been able to become leader of the Labour Party if the old right-wing management hadn't broken down, effectively committing suicide, to be honest, by attacking their trade union link. Because the trade unions, historically, were always very, very moderate and very supportive of the right wing of the party. By attacking the trade unions, and
what do you see as the actions that constituted an attack on the trade unions?
Well, you know, the reforms to the party structures, which reduced the influence of the trade union, particularly the trade union bureaucracy, in the determination of party policy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can argue about how democratic that was, and I think it's very complicated, these measures, because in some ways they were more democratic than the traditional party structure, and in some ways they were less, because they disenfranchised a lot of trade unionists who were already paying fees and so on. But anyway, nonetheless, the point is that they committed a form of suicide by essentially abandoning any distinctive Labour agenda, by adapting to a kind of post-Thatcherite consensus, so that when you had David Cameron standing against Labour...
with Gordon Brown at the...
Yeah, it was Gordon Brown by that point, yeah.
Yeah.
So basically the argument from the Tories was, initially, we're not going to argue with them on public spending totals. We're not going to challenge them on any of this stuff. What we're going to challenge them on is priorities. So we accept their overall targets, but we hit them on the priorities and we say, well, you know, we've got broken Britain. We should be spending more money on cooperatives and, you know, down with big government, up with local enterprise and all this sort of stuff. This was very feeble. And it wasn't until the banking crash and all the rest of it that they came up with something else, which was austerity. Mm-hmm. I've gone off on a tangent here. I'm just very associated.
I'm wondering, you say like you agree with Corbyn's rough agenda or elements of it, but you don't think that he can actually successfully implement it. So why do you think that, the latter point?
There's a few things. To have a successfully implementable agenda, you don't just have to convince the media that it's viable. You don't just have to convince your party and your parliamentary backbenchers that it's viable, or convince civil servants who will have to implement it that it's viable, or academics that it's actually coherent. You have to sort of negotiate between all of these things and then sort of be able to win over an electoral plurality. Now, I think it's feasible that the British public, or a plurality of the British public within the British electoral system, could at some stage, not now, at some stage, organise behind a kind of revived kind of social democracy, you know, state interventionism a little bit in the economy, more emphasis on public services, nationalising the big six energy companies, all that sort of stuff. I could see that happening. What I can't see is once you get in there and you try to implement that, you have to get business to invest. Mm. You can't make them invest unless you're going to nationalise them, which they're not going to do. So you have to persuade them that this is somehow in their interest. British business has never been particularly far-sighted. They're always interested in the bottom line, the short-term profitability, more so now than ever before. So you go to businesses and say, look, we're going to invest in the infrastructure. You're going to pay a bit more tax. You're going to pay higher wages. You're going to have more regulations. But in the long term, this is going to be good for you. And you have to persuade business to invest on that basis. Not going to happen. What's going to happen if he tries to implement this agenda, to be frank, is they're going to go on an investment strike. They're going to withhold their investment, because, as I say, the conditions aren't there for us. Mm-hmm. But there's also going to be some opposition from within the state, meaning we've already seen elements of the armed forces come out and say, if Corbyn tries to implement his agenda, there may be a military revolt. Now, that's over the top, but there would be a sort of opposition antagonism. Civil servants, senior civil servants would be saying...
That's because he is against the whole idea of there being like an interventionist military, right? And that completely goes against what the military like is kind of been bred and is there to do.
He's against, an interventionist military. Mm-hmm. And British military tradition is highly
interventionist. He wants it to look more like the Japanese model of there being kind of like a more of a TA model.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. I mean, actually, to be honest with you, that's the bit of Corbynism that is much more distinctive than anything else. Mm-hmm. All the other stuff is traditional Labour, right down the middle of Labourism. Mm. But this is a break, because Labour has always been pro-nuclear, pro-empire back in the day when there was an empire. It was very pro-empire.
Mm-hmm. We've still got Gibraltar.
Yes, yeah, and I think the Falklands.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And Northern Ireland. You know, so, I mean, there are still... nobody wants Northern Ireland. Nobody wants Northern Ireland, but you've got it. Tough shit.
It's
Northern Irish. It's your view that...
I am Northern Irish. But I should explain, I'm a self-hating proddy. So. I mean, I love you all, but go fuck yourself.
Is the problem Corbyn, or is it like as a personality, as a media figure, just a manager, let's say, or is it his program is just in the wrong place for the political climate at this time?
I think the program could feasibly get some support. I mean, if you look at the polls, generally speaking, the economic stuff is popular, right? And that's the stuff he would lead with. So that, I mean, in itself could be doable. There's something about his personality which I don't think they're making the best of it, because if you saw when he initially was winning the Labour leadership contest back in 2015, there were polls showing that of the candidates, he was the one that the public liked most. Right. The reason they liked him most, because he was pretty straightforward, he just said what he thought. Mm-hmm.
Nobody thought at the time that people would actually vote for him. Mm-hmm. I mean, we certainly
but
did.
No, but no. Even towards the end, there was a kind of sense like, he seems like a decent guy, you know, and that's the kind of thing that they should focus on.
Mm-hmm. It's a similar effect that Bernie Sanders had in the primaries in the US election, right, for the Democratic nomination.
Although Bernie Sanders has got something that Corbyn hasn't. I mean, Corbyn is not an aggressive personality. Mm-hmm. Now, he could be, I mean, if somebody would train him, he's got this sort of lupine sort of face, you know, like they're very wolfish. If they would train him to go on the attack more.
But he does make jam as a hobby, and that's,
yeah,
know,
yeah,
difficult to tell.
Makes jam, he's into horti fucking culture and all sorts of things.
Has a cat called El Gatto.
Well, you know, I mean, yeah, that is you know, that's a left wing tradition. cats are fine. But I think that his personality is one that has only a limited repertoire. Mm-hmm. He can come out and say what he thinks. He's very calm. He doesn't get ruffled. And, you know, that was very good for him during the coup, because anybody else would have just caved in. So, you know, that's his advantage. His disadvantage is that, of course, he's not a terribly charismatic person. He's somebody who essentially is not particularly good at communicating with the media or translating his idiom into theirs.
Is that because the media is so hostile to him, or is it, I mean, whose fault is that, or is it both their fault in a way?
The British social system is so structured that the media generally leans toward the establishment. That's true in every country.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, because they're looped into the establishment.
Yeah, yeah.
They're part of the policymaking process. So you come in from the left, you know that's going to happen, you expect it. And, you know, yeah, the system is going to be geared against you, the odds are going to be stacked against you. He knew that, he's not naive, and none of his supporters are either. They all knew this was going to be the way it would be. So there's no point in moralising about it, saying, you know, the stupid media. Yeah, we know the stupid media, but you have to work with the odds that you're given, mm-hmm, right? This is political struggle. This is not a morality play. So my worry is that at times Corbyn has been unwilling to be aggressive where he should be. So, for example, there was this Vice documentary last year, and it was
basically, this was the behind the scenes of Corbyn's media strip operation.
And it was taken to be like a sign of how incompetent they were, and it wasn't totally untrue. There was some incompetence, and one of the things was Corbyn refusing to go on the attack on personal independence payments when the government was in a real crisis over it, because he wanted to stick to the subject of refugees.
Mm.
I think, come back to refugees another time. This is the time to attack. Mm-hmm. Not enough aggression. And there's also this kind of thing like a politics of kindness. Great. We all need more kindness in politics. I'm sick to death of the sort of rancorous discussions you get on social media. But on the other hand, this is a fight. You know, you have to be willing to draw blood. And I'm afraid that there's just not enough aggression or hate, frankly.
In him, certainly, but there are definitely people who surround him who are quite happy to throw colleagues under the bus and to go on the attack. John McDonnell is the one that, like, springs to my mind.
Yeah, he's quite irascible, I understand. but in general, there's no coordination,
mm-hmm,
of this. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that I admire about the Blairites and Mandelson and that kind of ilk is that they've got the killer instinct. They've got, mm-hmm, a drive to win. And I didn't like anything about them politically or in any other way. But I think that kind of ruthlessness is what you need in that kind of situation.
Mm.
We should move on to our second topic, because we've had a lovely chin wag about Corbyn in the by-election.
And we did just mention online hate, so
look at you jumping on those segues,
right?
Like nobody. Yeah. So Milo Yiannopoulos, like towards the middle of February, was having a lovely time. He just appeared on the Bill Maher show.
Ma.
I don't bloody know. Who cares?
Come on, mate.
he was announced as a speaker at CPAC, which would have welcomed him.
It's an American conference.
Yeah, like, for like the conservatives.
The American conference for conservatives.
Yeah. And then was so there was a post on 4chan/poll that on late Sunday night on the 19th of February said that there was going to be a coordinated push to scorch earth Milo Yiannopoulos, based on a video that surfaced from him doing an interview with Joe Rogan, who's a podcaster and a radio presenter.
He's a stand-up comedian as well.
Yes. And in the interview, which happened about a year ago in January 2006, a lot of media are claiming that it's condoning of paedophilia.
I saw that podcast at the time,
mm,
and one of the things with Yiannopoulos is he does joke about that, about kind of
he's rather crude, isn't he?
He jokes about sex between adults and minors, like, mm-hmm, quite a lot. That's a part of his repertoire, if, mm-hmm, you like. And I I haven't seen that particular clip on the Joe Rogan podcast for a while, but I recall it was fairly jovial, and he has generally just been quite flippant about it. And it's one of those, a classic Yiannopoulos thing, you're never entirely sure how serious he's being.
He did talk about being abused by a priest when he was in his early teens, and he said about consensual sex, I was guessing we're talking about 13, about a 13 year old having sex with a 25 year old.
This was on a different podcast, the 13. Yes. So this was on the Drunken Peasants podcast the Amazing Atheist.
This has basically meant that he's been divorced from a lot of the alt-right and the conservative media. He has resigned as an editor at Breitbart, and he's had his $200,000 book deal cancelled by the publishers. There are rumours that it's going to probably be picked up by somebody else because, I mean, Milo is incredibly popular.
I mean, in broad terms, Richard, what do you actually make of Yiannopoulos as a phenomenon, let's say?
What do you think?
Okay.
Brace yourselves.
There's a few things here. First of all, Milo has aligned himself with the soft fascist wing of American politics, and the whole strategy, and, you know, this is something that's integral to the alt-right, so-called, the whole strategy of hedging your political agenda in a kind of trolling. So you can always say, oh, but it was just a joke. Well, okay, it was just a joke to some extent, but jokes are never just jokes, right? And they need to be analysed and unpicked. And actually, usually you find there's something serious behind it. There's a serious agenda. So when he goes on the attack against, say, trans people, does his talks, outs them, doxes them, attacks them, humiliates them. Yeah, it's a joke. It's a joke because he's humiliating them. He's enjoying that. And that's what everybody else is enjoying. So it's organized sadism in that way. In the same way, when he outs undocumented migrants, that is, again, part of a far-right agenda, and it's organized social sadism, and that's part of the joke as well. So you don't have to choose between one and the other. The thing I would say about his comments on sort of, if you like, intergenerational sex. I don't even know if I like that term, but sort of sex between adults and minors, let's put it like that, okay? Is that he is the last person who can talk about this, because everything he says is filled with bad faith. He has half-hedged agenda. He provokes, he retreats, he takes back what he said, then he says something else, and so on. You're never quite sure where you stand, and he mixes up quite valid points sometimes. So he adverted to the complexity of adolescent sexuality, consent and all that. But he did so for his own shock jock reasons. And he did it in such a way that it quickly became a really toxic conversation. You can't have the conversation on his terms. Now, I can come at this from the point of view of somebody, because I was abused as a child quite violently and sexually. And I felt like when this was coming out, I was worried by people's responses going, oh, he's a pedo. Well, he may or may not be. He may want to fuck children. We don't know. But what he said had a combination of things in it that you should seriously think about, but just not in relation to him, and stuff that was just pure provocation and shock jock. And what terrifies me about this whole subject is that we have an international conversation about child abuse, which is all focused upon the evil figure of the paedophile, as if it's these sort of weird outcasts who do this sort of stuff to children, rather than it being usually uncles, parents, brothers, these kinds of people who do this usually are authority figures who are trusted, rather than weird outsiders. And it also means that we end up not taking seriously the testimony of people who have had these experiences. So, for example, there was a woman who wrote about having sex with David Bowie when she was 14. Mm. It wasn't just sex, it was a relationship of some kind. But and she's totally... She doesn't regret it at all. She is quite seriously saying, I was not abused, I was glad of the experience, it was good for me, thank you. And I think... Anybody who wants to say to that person or to anybody else who was through an experience like that, well, doesn't matter. As far as I'm concerned, you couldn't consent and therefore you were abused. Mm-hmm. I think that is itself abusive because you're putting yourself in a position of omniscience, being a master of someone else's life story. You know better than them whether they were able to consent. I think that's outrageous. This is not an argument about the age of consent laws, because we need age of consent laws regardless, because laws are not perfect. Mm-hmm. They're pragmatic.
There are more kind of like nuanced versions of the age of consent law that we have in this country. In the UK it's 16 and it's pretty cemented, and it was lowered to be the same between heterosexual and homosexual relationships in 2001,
yes.
I believe. But there's places like in Spain, the age of consent is 13, and then amongst your peers, and then you can consent with older adults at the ages of 16.
Yes.
It's similar in like Germany and in other Northern European countries. So there's kind of like, I think there is kind of a fallacy in this country, at least, of there being kind of like a stopgap of this is where maturity begins and ends, and that's when consent can be done. Whereas there's other like systems that I think deal with it better.
I agree. Well, I mean, just to clarify some of the background here, most European countries have an age of consent at around 14 or 15, mm-hmm. And Latin American countries. In a number of countries, there are what are called, what you refer to as close-in age exceptions. Mm-hmm. So Canada has them, a number of American states have them. The problem with not having a nuanced system like that is that you end up punishing young people for their sexuality, and often this is homophobic or racist in application. There was a case of Janarlo Wilson, a 17-year-old black man, had sex with a 15-year-old white girl. The jury didn't even need to think about that. As far as they were concerned, he was a child molester. Mm. Two years between them. Mm-hmm. And it was consensual sex. And this girl, you know, had nothing to do with it. She didn't want to prosecute him, mm-hmm. as far as we know. There was another case where it was, an 18-year-old woman who had a long-term relationship with a 14-year-old girl. And the parents didn't like it. And, you know, basically because it was homosexual. Mm-hmm. So they went to the police and, you know, she was done for felony child abuse.
But it is enforced, it's enforced quite haphazardly, right? Like, there's a lot of cases that the police never get involved in, and there's some they do. So just from a law perspective, that's quite dodgy, because there's no certainty from...
It always depends upon the culture, mm-hmm. the moral culture and the political culture of policing. Mm-hmm. And it's very dependent on local and national situations. In America, of course, they've got a history of Jim Crow. Georgia cops were never going to go lightly mm-hmm. on a black man in that circumstance. And but I mean, just to say, the law is never going to be completely perfect. Mm-hmm. It's always going to define an acceptable bandwidth of acceptable behavior, mm-hmm. which will include some harmful behavior, but at the same time it's also going to outlaw some harmless behavior.
Yeah.
It's always going to be a bit like that. So we shouldn't get too hung up on exactly what the age is, and we should allow for the fact that there will be exceptions that the law won't cover, and that's just a reality.
But something I thought was really interesting with Yiannopoulos and his story was that when he stepped down as an editor at Breitbart, he actually described himself as a victim of sexual abuse, which I...
Previously he'd sort of denied that, I understood, but...
I find it surprising that him, from kind of like the free speech, anti-social justice warrior, snowflakes are terrible kind of view of the world, I was surprised that he so, well, maybe I'm wrong to say so readily, but that he was able to kind of use that term for himself.
Well, he's disingenuous so often that, you know, it's...
Do you think he was disingenuous in this case as well?
It's hard to say. It's almost impossible to say what Yiannopoulos thinks about anything, which is not something you can say about most pundits, right? Mm-hmm. Most pundits, you know that they have a view, you know they have principles, there's a framework, there's all these things. But Yiannopoulos is just an unreliable actor, basically.
Ethically, I think we have to take people seriously when they say they've been abused. But taking them seriously doesn't mean automatically believing everything they say, because memory and also people are always more complex than you know would appear. And I think the fact that he's contradicting himself here, there's an element of political performance in that, but also I think it may reflect the fact that, as with many people, you're not really sure whether he was abused or not.
He has conflicting emotions about the experience.
He may have reflected on it, but he may not have been able to settle the question. And often people who've been through experiences like that, and, you know, I've talked to people who've gone through experiences like that, and they change their mind from, maybe I wasn't really in a position where I could consent. I mean, you know, I enjoyed it, but if I did, does that make me a bad person? Mm-hmm. All this kind of stuff. And I'm worried to some extent by the fact that because it's Milo Yiannopoulos and because he's such an unpleasant person who goes, who victimizes people, shows no conscience at all, and aligns himself with the sort of the soft fascist wing of American politics, that it becomes easier to take an unnuanced position on the issues that he raises.
Can you elaborate on the soft fascist point? What do you mean by that in policy terms?
In policy terms, I think that he is a supporter of Donald Trump, and I think that he's a supporter of Marine Le Pen, and he spends a lot of time...
He's very clearly a supporter of both of those people. There's not a lot of ambiguity.
Right. So I guess there is a question which is related to the one you're answering right now. Does he actually have a policy agenda that he's passionate about, or is it all showmanship and it's about his ego? Or is it both of those things?
We don't have to assume there's any depth there. There is just what he says.
Uh-huh.
And so we just go with what he says, and what he says is consistently on the hard sort of it's the hard right, let's put it like that, and I actually think it does tend towards support for fascist figures like Le Pen and so on, and it's, I don't think that he is necessary. I mean, for example, his Catholic homophobia, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's very consistent on this. But at the same time, he also wants...
He's a Catholic gay man.
He's a Catholic gay man.
An awful lot of, kind of self-loathing... Yeah, and like homophobic rhetoric to a lot of the stuff that he...
Does he want the law to be against him? Does he want to be punished by the law? Well, maybe. It's hard to say. Mm-hmm. But I think that he occupies an ambiguous position. That's why I say soft. But also, I would also say soft for another reason. Fascism in America is not in a developed state. I think what we're seeing is a kind of neonate... germinal kind of fascism, which is not yet ideologically consolidated and is not yet organizationally organized and doesn't have the kind of traditional sort of, you know, back in the 20s and 30s we'd have been talking about paramilitaries, you know,
mm-hmm.
not talking about alt-right bands. And there are armed far-right individuals in the United States, militias,
yeah.
clans and all the rest of them. But that hasn't consolidated into a fascist movement, and I'm not sure where Yiannopoulos would stand in that, because, to be honest, there's a wing of the alt-right in America that thinks, you know, they think he's Jewish, so they hate him for that.
Mm.
They know he's gay, so they hate him for that. And they think he's a sort of, because of their conspiratorial mindset, they think he's smuggling in some kind of liberal virus into the fascist movement.
I think that actually he does, despite the fact that he is able to flip-flop an awful lot on a lot of topics and isn't really representative of a lot of the harder elements of the alt-right.
Yeah.
And he himself says that he isn't a part of the alt-right, he's just kind of like an ally, but he does
pretty much have... every major figure you'd associate with the alt-right denies being part of the alt-right.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that means very much.
So one of the branches of the alt-right that I think that he is very representative of is that values free speech so highly.
Dislikes political correctness.
Yeah, exactly. And that, I think, if he does have any kind of clear view on the world, he has that view on the world where he wants to be able to say whatever he wants. He wants everybody to say whatever they want, no matter who is offended and no matter who thinks that they shouldn't be able to say that. I think that if he has anything, he at least has that in terms of his integrity.
How do you square his position on free speech with his association with soft fascism, as you put it? Is that purely so that he can advance his policy agenda? Does he actually believe in free speech, do you think? Because that free speech is obviously antithetical to fascism.
We're talking about him as if he's a politician, though, and he just...
He is a political figure, right?
I think in terms of free speech, there's a lot of confused discussion about this, because in the United States, free speech means something like this. The state shall pass no laws to prohibit various forms of speech. Now, he's not prohibited from doing what he does, but what he's pushing back against is a cultural presumption of a kind of civility.
Mm-hmm.
He's pushing back against civility in the name of free speech. So he wants to normalize racist, transphobic, sexist, homophobic, oppressive languages, basically, and languages which are quite violent. And this is not so much about... defending speech and conversation, because these are, you know, when you start attacking people, that's when the conversation stops, is when people start picking up weapons, you know, and that's why he ended up, you know, with riots and so on. That's why Richard Spencer got punched in the face, because there's a certain point beyond which the conversation is impossible. It's a deadlock.
Mm-hmm.
If you say I'm not a human being, I'm not going to debate that with you. I'm going to fucking headbutt you, you know, and that's essentially what's happened. I think that it's a sabotage of free speech, because for speech to take place, there needs to be a certain set of preconditions. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to talk as if we have a shared ground, a shared foundation. We're all basically, you know, I profoundly disagree with Tories, but we all basically agree on some fundamental
things like the rule of
ideas.
Law.
Yeah, well, I'm against the rule of law, frankly.
but in a kind of bad example.
In a kind of utopian way, you know, I'd like to supersede the rule of law at some point in a kind of naive, anarcho-utopian way. You know, probably never going to happen. There's certain founding assumption. Like, basically, at least there's the assumption that we're all roughly equal, mm-hmm. Even if we're not. You know, ethically, we're all equal.
In some abstract sense.
Right. Even if we're not equal in a real sense. It would be possible to have a debate with somebody who accepted that. Mm. But for somebody who is not out really to... There's another aspect of this, which is trolling, which is where a lot of this comes from. The strategy of trolling. The troll doesn't really care about what they're saying, in a sense.
They care about the reaction.
Right.
Yeah.
So they want your outrage. Now, that has become instrumentalized, become weaponized behind a far-right politics, because there's a sense in which they both do and don't take seriously what they're saying. They do take seriously what they're saying, but they care much more about getting the liberal outrage and producing a series of reactions. So this is an attack on conversation.
But isn't it also somewhat a response? I mean, this is the only argument I think you can use to legitimise it, but to what Yiannopoulos calls outrage culture, which is this idea that there are certain people, predominantly on the left, who will get outraged over any perceived minor transgression of what they view to be correct morals and correct politics. And to some degree, all the alt-right have done, or how they started, is just to antagonise those kind of instincts.
I think that this is one of those things where we have to wrestle the subject back from Yiannopoulos and the alt-right, because mm-hmm. I do think there's an outrage culture. I don't think it's specific to the left, but I think that what's happened, what I've noticed, is that particularly with social media, there's a thing about social media which is that everybody is engaged on the basis of accumulating likes. That's the structure of it. Mm-hmm. You get likes and retweets.
Yeah, it's a human thing. You get endorphins get fired for your
brain.
Yeah,
you do.
That happens.
So there's a thing that, in order to find out what you're like, you go on social media and you look at your metrics. How many likes have I got today? Mm. And that's your reward. So when you talk to people on social media, quite often they're not really paying attention to what you say. They're paying attention to what they can say about it in order to get likes. So you get this kind of grandstanding.
Isn't that true of human conversation to some degree?
I don't think so, because I think face-to-face conversation is very, very different. And I mean, I'm long enough in the tooth to remember a time on the British left, for example, where the divisions were along sectarian lines rather than competitive individualism and narcissism, right? So it was like, it could be poisonous, but it was poisonous along, like, we don't want to work with your party because your party sucks and this kind of thing, You know, going back, it would have been Cold War divisions and so on. Mm-hmm. But what's happened now has become really, really toxic and invidious, because your very sort of sense of yourself, your existence is involved. It's no longer just about a political position. If your political position is being disagreed with, then it's like you're under attack.
But politics has always been somewhat that way, right? People do personalise
their views. There's always been an element of that, but I think it was much more in the box. I think that now that it's been looped into a structure of daily rewards for sort of tending to this cultivated self. I mean, you think about it. You put a profile picture, an autobiographical line, and you curate yourself through what you write. So you're curating and creating yourself on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And therefore, any political argument is inflected through that. Whereas if you have a political party and you turn up at a debate, yes, there will be elements of personalization going on, but it's constrained and structured within democratic institutions, within institutions of legitimacy, and also there's what you might call a meta-narrative. Everybody kind of agrees with an overall set of principles and priorities and a set of strategic orientations. There's some sort of a basic underlying agreement, so there's a limitation on what can happen. when all that breaks down, as it has been on the left for 30 or 40 years, you know, it becomes much more about competitive individualism and narcissism. And
would you tie what you're talking about into kind of the rise of individualism and consumerism more generally in the West? And consumer culture and, you know, buying clothes to express your individuality and all the rest of it?
There's a way of attacking consumerist culture which is very moralistic, you know. Like, oh, you shouldn't enjoy nice things.
Mm.
Fuck that. I want nice things. But
you could say this is one of the downsides of being able to get nice things and such.
It's the particular way that capitalism organises it. I think Adam Phillips, the psychoanalyst, made the point that capitalism is for kids in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are supposed to never be frustrated. Even if you've got very little money, at the bottom of the market, there's always a range of things that you can get, a range of little satisfactions. So you never have to be too frustrated. You can always get something. Mm-hmm. So at the bottom of the market, it used to be when Woolworths was open, I remember, like, you know, if you didn't have much money, you'd go and get loads of DVDs. And, mm-hmm. you know, things really, really cheap. That's what capitalism does. So I think that there's a sense in which it organizes satisfactions on the basis of never having to delay gratification, never having to do anything creative or productive. And it's a, you know, I mean, in a way, that's a recipe for always only ever having sort of minor satisfactions. So in the same way that you can go into a shop and get, like, if you're addicted to a particular kind of chocolate bar or so on, you can go to the shop and get that. Now you can go on social media and you can make the same kind of statement on a daily basis. So if your thing is making dark jokes, you can make that on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. You'll get a certain amount of likes. And you can orchestrate your sort of reward. But you're always wasting time worrying about yourself,
mm-hmm.
the self and how it's perceived and how it's received in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that, it seems to me, takes away from something else that's very important to social media. Social media is a form of writing.
Mm-hmm.
More people now are published authors than have ever been before. And the reward now is no longer money. You get likes. You get attention.
Or verified approval. On Twitter.
Verified, yeah. The best, the blue tick. Yes, I mean, but or Facebook or whatever. But writing now is being looped into this thing of can I get enough likes on a daily basis? Meaning that actually the satisfaction that you can get from it is being drained away.
Who'd have thought that Milo Yiannopoulos was actually a victim of our capitalist culture? Poor guy.
No, he's capitalised on it. Just like Donald Trump, actually. I mean, if you think about Trump, he's the first reality television president. He was made by that show.
Mm.
That libidinal moment where he stares at the person, his victim, and says, "You're fired."
Mm-hmm.
And that's the libidinal high of the show. It's like, yes! Get him, boss.
Mm-hmm.
And he made himself into a kind of a chief executive for the nation through that media performance.
We really should segue into, because there's no cool way of being able to segue into this, into the ruling that the court had on heterosexual couples being able to use civil partnerships rather than marriages to, like, represent their relationships. Mm. Jimmy, explain what happened, because you know things.
Well, my understanding of the judgment, of which you can
well
read...
Well done for hedging at the beginning. My understanding is...
My understanding hedges everything, so okay. But the summary of the judgment, from what I can gather, says that, in principle, the judges think that the straight couple could have a case that their human rights are being breached under the European Convention of Human mm-hmm. Rights, which is... can be considered in British law.
Mm-hmm. We should first of all actually say that civil partnerships were introduced in 2005 by the Labour government as kind of like a stopgap on the way to same-sex marriage.
Yeah, so this couple feel that marriage is too laden with historical baggage.
Patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. About, I mean, if you look at standard marriage ceremony, it very much is the husband effectively buying the bride off the bride's father. There's still like elements of that in the ceremony. So they would for us get a civil partnership, but
mm-hmm.
so the reason the judges said, yeah, you might potentially have a case. However, the government is considering this at the moment. It's reviewing whether it's going to abolish civil partnerships or open them up to straight couples, mm-hmm. or they don't know entirely what they're going to do at the moment. But that's the reason. The British judicial system has a habit of not not preempting government action mm-hmm. if it can. It's far less combative compared to like the US legal system.
So Jimmy, you have a tendency of not giving your actual opinion on things on this podcast. Yeah, so don't worry, I've noticed. This is something that directly affects you. And your ability to express yourself to the outside world as a straight man.
Yes.
How would you like to have the option of having a civil partnership rather than a marriage? Do you see there being a difference between the two?
There's very minor technical differences between civil partnerships mm-hmm. and marriages. There's actually a government document online, you can go look them up, but they're very, very small things. Like one of them is in a civil marriage, if you're husband or wife has got an STD that you weren't aware of, that is grounds for annulment in a marriage. It is not grounds for annulment in a civil partnership. Mm-hmm. So it's tiny things like that. I also think marriage is better recognised abroad than civil partnerships are, but mm-hmm. I'm not 100% sure about that. So marriage is effectively the better vehicle from a point of view of legal protection, mm-hmm. right? And
so you're being very analytical about it,
yes,
as you always are.
I'm about to give my opinion.
Excellent. I just want to hurry you along.
I think these people are wasting the court's time. To be honest with you, okay. I think that. I mean, my own parents had. You can have a civil marriage ceremony. You can have a religious marriage ceremony. My parents went to a registry office and got married that way. Mm-hmm. There's nothing religious about it. It's very clinical, very secular in that sense. Mm-hmm. And I basically think these people want a marriage. They just don't want to call it a marriage. Mm-hmm. And I just find that a bit pretentious, frankly.
So I believe that people, like, we're in a world where relationships are. Being recognised in lots of different ways, like mm-hmm. you no longer like women, I think don't often get given away at the altar by their parents. You will often have partners cohabiting for a significant amount of time before they have marriage, before they get married. Ooh, naughty. And I think that the more and relationships are complicated, and I think that the more options that exist for couples to be able to enter into an agreement with one another, I think the better. And if there is a if a couple has particular problems with the institution of marriage, which lots of people do have, there are lots of queer people who, when same-sex marriage was legalised in this country, were like, well, why would I want to have the right to marry, because marriage itself is flawed, and I like, actually we should be walking towards something else.
But I think in practice that has happened underneath the legal vehicle of marriage. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you just look at the granting of divorce as well, it used to be in the UK you used to have a parliamentary bill put through the House of Commons and the House of Lords in order to get a divorce, mm-hmm. and then they reformed it so that anyone can get one for almost any reason. And that fundamentally changed the nature of marriage. People have been, as you say, cohabiting before they get married. Mm-hmm. There used to be a huge social stigma against that. People have children out of wedlock and then get married. Marriage has changed beyond all conception. To say that it is laden with the historical baggage is actually to ignore the post-war history of marriage.
But then people probably want the legal protections of marriage without having to go through all of the historical stuff. Maybe
They don't have to. You just go down to a registry office. We could actually do this right now. Me and you could just go down to a registry office.
I mean, are you proposing to
me? I'm not proposing. I'm just saying, marriage is
I mean, I thought that there'd be more fanfare, to be honest.
Marriage is what you imbue it with, is mm-hmm. my view. But Richard, you've been silent thus far.
Uncharacteristically so. Yeah. I slightly lean in your direction, Jimmy, in as much as I don't see much of a difference between a sort of registry office marriage and a civil partnership. In a way, I can see that marriage is, the idea of marriage is saturated with these traditions. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be that way if you don't want it to be that way. Mm. What I'm interested in, though, is the whole idea, the idea of a civil partnership. It sounds like a very contract-based kind mm-hmm. of relationship. Mm. Whereas, and maybe that's just where we're going in terms of modernity. Maybe the idea of having a kind of, you know, some sort of sacred union, you know, that's disappearing. And maybe it's the language of civil partnership, of just having a contract, you know. Mm. We are merging our capital for now, And if it continues to be advantageous to us, we'll continue to merge our capital. But if at some point one of us is at a disadvantage, then we will have an amicable separation and form new enterprises. You know,
I don't think it's going to take over as common marriage vows, that sort of thing.
So I actually went to a really interesting talk from Peter Tatchell, who was talking about the move from, in terms of LGBT people, moving away from the idea of having equality and towards something more of liberation. Liberation being where something completely new that isn't constrained by all of the shit that is like the baggage of society. Something new is created. Yeah. And he actually suggested something that wasn't quite a civil partnership or a marriage, where it was like a pick and mix contract that you can have. That I want this person to be able to decide whether they turn off the machine if I am comatose, but I don't want to have to share all of my assets with them, for example, and being able to like pick and choose for each couple, because each couple is different, and the idea of there being kind of like a one-size-fits-all model for every single relationship out there might actually solve some of the problems when it comes to divorce proceedings, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think psychoanalysis puts it, chaos under the kingdom of heaven, you know, meaning under the kingdom of Oedipus, sorry. that was a very interesting slip. Heaven, Oedipus.
Potato, potato.
Yeah, it's essentially the same thing. So, but basically what that means is there's a growing number of sex roles. You can be not just, trans, but you can be a boyish girl or a girlish boy and so on. So there's this proliferation of different roles, and therefore also a proliferation of different kinds of relationships between people, romantic and sexual. And the attempt to contrive a legal situation in which legally that would be recognised is obviously very interesting. But I just wonder if it's not just futile, because all relationships are to some extent contractual. There's always a set of implied understandings. But of course, both parties are always in the dark about what the other side implies or understands.
I mean, that obviously doesn't happen. So, for example, the prenup is like was actually quite revolutionary when it came to marriages.
I mean, the prenup is kind of what Thatcher was talking about with a more pick and choose marriage contract.
Like more options for a prenup when you enter into that kind of a contract with somebody else.
Would kind of take a lot of the romance out of the whole marriage act.
You can still have a fancy ceremony.
It's to be like, I really like you, but I'm not really down with sharing all my assets. I've, saved quite a lot, and I'm not really sure you're, someone I want to share that with.
Might
saw the relationship a little bit, is all I'm saying.
This is a question that I have. Why do you want to have it sealed in law? I mean, it used to be the idea, and I think possibly an illusory idea, but nonetheless it was the idea that you two were destined to be together forever. Union of sorts or whatever.
Yeah.
Under God. Given that it's moved onto a kind of civil contractual basis, why do you want it to have the force of law? Is there a sense of it can be? I can understand it could be related to personal insecurity. Like, I don't want you to be able to leave me too easily, that kind of thing. But beyond that,
well, there's the thing about if you die, you want your assets to move easily to your loved ones. Although I suppose you could just do that through a will, but I think there's tax things and other reasons why you might not want to do that. But there's also the we were discussing about this before the podcast, the kill switch thing, which is that if your husband or wife is in a horrific accident and they're being kept alive by a machine for 3 months and the doctors finally say, look, somebody needs to make a decision on this, if you're not married to them, it's a lot harder for you to do that.
Your next closest next of kin will be brought in.
Yeah, I mean, there's been loads of arguments in the US about before gay marriage was made legal via the Supreme Court, there were situations where, couples, one of them had been hospitalized or something like that, and they weren't at the partner was not allowed visitation rights and all that.
And
sort of
like, there's examples where somebody's partner died in the US before gay marriage came in, and they weren't. And then their partners, who they'd been with for like 10 years, was then taken away from them by the family, who hadn't actually had contact with this guy since they'd come out.
So there are legal reasons why you would want a marriage, but I get your whole point.
The problem then is, I mean, first of all, in terms of like what happens to your property after you're dead. You're dead.
Why do you care? Why do you want the law to perpetuate? I mean, this is one of the whole problems of the class society. It's mostly based on inheritance. But I think if you're dead, you don't get... I think if you're dead, we should come and take your property away and give it to pigeons or anything, but give it to your children, your stupid, dim children.
Hashtag give it to the pigeons. Do you think
other than their children. The children of the rich should not get anything. Okay, but apart from that, the kill switch, right? That's a really important thing. Mm. But isn't the point that you want somebody who loves you to make that decision? Somebody who loves you rather than... somebody who's got a legal obligation to you, because it seems to me that's the problem. Unfortunately, that ideal, I mean, you do really want it to be somebody who loves you, but you can't really guarantee it.
Had an argument the night before.
Ultimately, maybe the best thing is you want a medical professional who kind of knows whether or not you're alive or dead. Like, remember Terry Schiavo? Okay, so this was back in 2005. Terry Schiavo was a woman. Her brain was liquid. She was dead, right? All her physical signs were dead. They just kept using machine to keep blood pumping through. Right. So, basically they were keeping this vegetating body alive. Like,
alive, just not rotting, I suppose.
You know, I don't want the medical establishment to have the right to decide who lives or dies, but if you're already dead... then, you know, maybe there are some cases that are fairly clear. But so the point is, I'm wary of going too far in either direction, because on the one hand, I don't want it to be too rationalized, where a doctor or somewhere says, okay, that person is probably dead or dying or will die in a minute. Turn the machine
off. Would most doctors appreciate having that responsibility foisted on them?
There are some doctors, I think, who would love it. the godlike powers... I think there's some doctors, don't forget, there's a history, the medical establishment in Nazi Germany were quite happy to experiment with the concentration camp victims and so on.
Oh, and that point, we've invoked Hitler and we've lost all of the... Godwin's law. We really should wrap it. It's fine, it's a wonderful point to end on.
On Nazi doctors, we'll try and wrap this up.
I don't want anyone to think all doctors are Nazis.
Just some of them. Where can our lovely listeners find you if they want to read more and listen to more of you?
Mostly they can find me on my blog, Lenin's Tomb, which is a place of undead ideas, as you can imagine. If they want to find other stuff, they should look me up on LRB, Guardian, or whatever. Or my Twitter account's Leninology.
Excellent. And if you would like to wade into the debate with us at any point, please find us on Twitter. You can find the podcast at Right Dishonor. You can find me at Jazza John. And if you disagree with anything that Jimmy says, you can find him at JDE Nichols. Although most people agree with you recently.
Yeah, I've been
really annoying.
Getting a lot of tweets saying that people agree with me, I guess I just have better opinions than you.
Please do leave us 5 stars on iTunes. Please. Don't worry, we'll wait while you do it now.
Okay.
Yeah? Okay, cool. Bye.